Hello, I am Emma, the 11th Duchess of Rutland, and this is Duchess, a podcast in which I explore the most historic homes of the UK and meet the inspiring women who lead them. As a daughter of a Welsh farmer, I grew up far away from the glamour and wealth of aristocracy, but my life changed forever when I fell in love and married my husband, the 11th Duke of Rutland. Suddenly, one of Britain's most historic buildings was not only my home, but under my care. I wanted to hear the stories of other women like me, the custodians of these great homes. So in this podcast, I will travel to breathtaking homes and meet the inspiring women who lead these estates today. Please join me on this special journey. This is Duchess, the podcast. Woodstock, Oxfordshire, is home of one of Britain's greatest landmarks, Blenheim Palace, the birthplace of one of Britain's iconic leaders, Winston Churchill, the seat of the Dukes of Marlborough, and a UNESCO World Heritage Site. Blenheim is a true palace. Designed as a rare English Baroque style, Blenheim is architecturally flamboyant, breathtaking, and expansive. Abounding with a 90-metre courtyard, rolling gardens, and lavishly executed interiors, the palace, designed by the architect John Bamborough, was built to be symbolic, a home for the glorious heroes of the great British Empire. And in a way, this prophecy would be fulfilled. Now the palace continues to awe and inspire at the helm of the Spencer Churchills. Today, I meet the ever-inspiring Lady Henrietta Spencer Churchill. Henrietta grew up at Blenheim, and her experiences here would lay the groundwork for her becoming one of the UK's leading interior designers. She has devoted her life to the preservation and restoration of British design, and I'm so excited to have her on the show. Lovely to have you here with me.
Well, very welcome.
And if I can just set the scene. So Lady Henrietta is not actually the lady of the house, but she is the lady who has supported this palace. But I would say for the last two generations, and I'm sure we'll be going into the next generations of dukes. Would that be correct?
Well, I hope so. Yes, certainly very much started with my father, who was the 11th Duke. And I always had a particular role, I guess, certainly on the restoration side of the house.
And then your brother is now the Duke,
my Jamie. Brother and his lovely wife, Edla, are the 12th Duke and Duchess.
Blenheim Palace sits rather majestically to the side of Woodstock Village. How many miles? 5-6 miles from Oxford city centre?
I'd say around 6 miles.
And from London, about an hour.
Depending on the time of day, yes.
Absolutely.
But no, we're very fortunate in that sense because we are in the centre of England and we're very accessible. So thus, in terms of tourism, we're perfectly located.
You certainly are, and we're very envious of that. Will you share with our listeners today, Henrietta, how the building was built and your titles and everything about how and why we are here today, sitting here outside the walls of the main palace?
Well, we've been here for over 300 years. So as many of your listeners, I'm sure, know, that Blenheim was a gift from Queen Anne and a grateful nation to my great ancestor, John Churchill, who subsequently became the first Duke of Marlborough, title bestowed on him by Queen Anne. And he got to that position by being a very famous general, in particular winning the wars of the Spanish succession in the early 1700s. in particular, the most famous one was the Battle of Blenheim, thus why this wonderful palace is called Blenheim. So Blenheim was built in 1705. The architect was Sir John Vanbrugh. Before that, he'd done Castle Howard. So he'd sort of cut his teeth on Castle Howard. And you'll see some similarities in the architecture. But as you know, he was formerly a playwright, so he didn't have a lot of architectural experience. By this time, he'd married Sarah Jennings, who was a very formidable and very successful businesswoman in her own right. She became a great friend of Queen Anne. Subsequently, they fell out. I'm sure many of your listeners have watched the film The Favourite, which doesn't portray either of them particularly well. But it was that fantastic partnership which they had together, very strong marriage, that got them to where they are. So Blenheim took 25 years to be built. There was a period during that time when they had to go into self-imposed exile for a couple of years in Europe after Sarah had fallen out with Queen Anne. So the building work stopped, resumed again, and 25 years later we have this magnificent palace.
Goodness.
Blenheim is a Baroque palace. It's Baroque architecture, very much influenced by those other Baroque homes in Europe. And I always say Baroque doesn't do small. I mean, Baroque is big scale, grand.
And it took 25 years.
Which is not really surprising.
No.
If you think of the scale, and if you think that everything was done by hand, they didn't have machinery in those days. You know, everything was carved by hand. It was all the stone was taken from local quarries by horse and carriage. I always find it phenomenal. I mean, can you imagine someone trying to build this today? Just take them 25 years anyway.
It's fascinating that it survived for 300 years. I'm sure there have, like all stately homes, been ups and downs. Would you be able to mark a moment when someone has come in and saved this palace?
Well, I think we probably can go back to the fourth Duke to begin with, because there are certain Dukes who are have significant and they've added a lot to the house. There are others who unfortunately have taken away. But the fourth Duke was very fortunate because he inherited at a very young age, aged 18, and was a very wealthy young man. Fortunately, he did spend his wealth wisely, and he was the one who employed Capability Brown in around 1760 and built the lake, as well as many other things. He built up a wonderful collection of furniture, artworks, etc. And then moving on from him, we're now in the Victorian times, the seventh Duke. I think the important thing to note about the seventh Duke is then how the lineage goes on to Winston Churchill. So Winston Churchill, because he wasn't the eldest son, he was the younger son. So he was the younger son of Randolph and Jenny. So it was his brother who became the eighth Duke. And he, because he was, you know, the same family, had the title Spencer Churchill, but actually was not a Duke.
Absolutely. But he famously was born here. Is that correct?
So he was basically born here. By default, not by design, because his parents, Jenny and Randolph, were spending the weekend here. It was a big shooting party, a big weekend party. And one of the stories goes that it was the rumbling of the carriages on the cobbles that brought the birth on early. And there's another story which goes, Jenny was dancing very vigorously in the long library and being thrown around the room, and that brought on the birth early. When this story was related to Winston later on in his life, and somebody says, well, why were you born in Blenheim? He says, well, actually, I can't recall.
And what would be one of your fond memories of Sir Winston?
Well, I don't really remember him that well, to be honest. I was pretty young when he died. I didn't go to the funeral. I was too young, but my brother went with my father. And I remember watching the parade out of the window of the Savoy Hotel.
Goodness.
In London with Nanny.
The Nanny who became the Rock.
Nanny who was with us basically all our life and actually ended up marrying the butler, so she was very much part of the family.
But still there is always one member of the family who comes in or is lucky enough in themselves to create enormous wealth, who really turns the test of time with these great heritage sites. Which one would that be in your family?
Well, definitely the ninth Duke, who was my great-grandfather. It was made pretty clear to him by his grandmother, Fanny, who was the seventh Duchess, that he really needed to save Blenheim. And he basically sacrificed his life to save Blenheim. And he had an arranged marriage with Consuela Vanderbilt, who was a very wealthy American heiress from Alabama, the Deep South. She came back here. It wasn't a happy marriage, but she dutifully produced her heir and her spare, so my grandfather and great uncle. She was actually the most wonderful custodian of Blenheim. She had great taste. She decorated it in a beautiful way. She obviously had lots of money to do that. I was always going to Paris to buy furnishings and fabrics as well as beautiful ball gowns. And so it's very much thanks to her that Blenheim is today in pretty good shape, because he was able to spend the money on the property, which other dukes had perhaps neglected or didn't have the money to do. When the house was built, there was no sort of grand parterre like you might see in somewhere like Versailles. It was very much about the landscape. And then, of course, the fourth Duke with capability, Brown, created wonderful undulating landscape. But it wasn't until the ninth Duke that the formal gardens were actually installed. So it wasn't grand at all, the gardens before that.
No, it was quite simple. But the Vanderbilt money brought in the grandeur, the sort of Versailles-type gardens that surround Blenheim to this day. And the Blenheim brand would be known certainly in America, China?
Getting much better.
Far East?
Well, we have a lot of Far Eastern visitors. Not on a normal year, we'd have a lot of Far Eastern visitors. We're certainly missing them this year.
And how many visitors do you usually have around Blenheim each year?
Normally, on an average year, we'll have up to around 700,000.
Winston Churchill once said, "We shape our buildings, thereafter they shape us." What do you think he meant by this?
I suppose you can interpret it in various ways. It could be, take Blenheim as a case, they shape us because it's actually a burden and we're lumbered with this and we have to live with it and make the most of it, as the best of it as we can. Equally, you could look at it as thinking, well, aren't I lucky to be living in such a wonderful, magnificent home? It's my duty to look after it and make the most of it. It's part of our heritage, and, you know, we're very lucky to be part of it. I mean, it is a burden. Of course, it's a burden for everyone who's involved, but it's an asset to be involved in helping maintain such a important and beautiful property.
I read somewhere, was it not decided by Hitler that if the Second World War, they had invaded Britain and taken over, that Hitler decided to make it his home?
Well, dream on, Hitler.
Dream on, indeed. It inspires me so much hearing Henrietta's passion for heritage. A role of custodianship is such a privilege, but it's also an enormous responsibility. You've been listening to Duchess, the podcast presented by me, Emma Rutland, and produced by One Fine Play in collaboration with Beaver Castle. Henrietta's continual drive to improve and grow the estate convinces me Blenheim's future is absolutely secure. I was curious to learn where this passion for heritage came from, and to learn more about Henrietta's childhood here, and what it is actually like growing up in such a grand home. When did you arrive here as a child? Because I don't think you weren't born here, Henrietta.
No, I wasn't born here because my grandfather was still alive when I was a child. And so he was occupying the house. And actually, it's interesting to note that in his day, he did open the house to the public, but it wasn't nearly the commercial operation as it is today. So he very much ran Blenheim as a private home. I have to say, we probably spent more time outside than inside, because I was rather terrified of my grandfather. He'd sit in his green leather chair with Ben the Boxer and sort of do a lot of gruffling.
Lovely.
But we were put to work. We'd go and help in the kitchen garden picking fruit, or we might go and help in the very modest gift shop which we had in those days.
And there's rumours about you and Jamie spending a lot of time on the roof.
We used to go wherever we could, to be honest. It was just fun exploring and obviously friends. And then more latterly, when we became teenagers, my father took us water skiing on the lake, which, of course, you'd never be allowed to do today because of health and safety. But we literally used to water ski most weekends in the summer on the lake, and we'd have parties down at the boathouse. But I guess my role as getting involved didn't really happen until much later.
And if we can just go back one step, because your father has been instrumental in the palace as we see it and know it today. Is that correct?
I think during his lifetime, the biggest changes have happened, because it's gone from being a very much a family home and an estate which had to make money for it to run. So during his tenure, it had to become much more commercial. So having gone from having just an estate manager, we now have a very big management team. And the vast amount of our income comes from visitors. But I think the key I find is very important is that we still maintain the fact that it's a family home. It's a family-owned home. A lot of the cachet of the house and why people want to come here is because it's A, Churchill was born here and everybody knows about Churchill, but B, it's gone through the lineage of the Churchill family and, you know, hopefully will continue to for many years.
And of course, you've only got to visit a home that is lived in by family members or a museum type house that has been handed over to the National Trust and realise the heartbeat of private heritage is the family living in them. Mm. I found exactly the same at Beaver, but the magic of being able to have family weekends when the children can bring their friends
yeah.
and enjoy it as a yeah. home, keep it alive. And more importantly for me, as I find private heritage, and not in any way saying anything against the National Trust, but there have been women at the helm who've maintained the touch of it being a family home, and it hasn't been stuck in time.
I think that's so important. And, you know, I think we pride ourselves here on A, the maintenance of the house, and I get very involved with the restoration projects because that's my passion, that's my business. And we have various different foundations which help support. We have an American foundation, we have a UK foundation which helps support and maintain the infrastructure of the house. But as I say, the vast amount of the revenue comes from visitors as well as other events that are held throughout the year, you know, when we can have them.
So this great palace with its hinterland of your, I think, 11,000 acres and certain properties help create the revenue with the house visitors to keep it all together.
Absolutely. And, you know, always thinking new ways. I mean, more recently we've gone into doing quite a lot of housing developments in conjunction with the local county council, because you've always got to be innovative in ways to make money.
It's not quite as glamorous, perhaps, as it would appear looking in as an outsider.
No, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, a lot of people, they come and they see this fabulous palace. I'm sure they appreciate how well it's run and how beautifully it's maintained. And I think we pride ourselves on that. But, you know, it's costs a huge amount of money and there's always work to be done. And there's so much that goes on behind the scenes, whether it's, you would know, whether it's rewiring or making it far protective, the heating. It's just so many things which you don't visually see, but which have to be done.
Again, we'll sound as if we're bleating, and I'd hate any of our listeners to think.
No, we're not, certainly not bleating, but I think it's important for people to understand that it's a very, you know, my father always said he was always fighting the Battle of Blenheim, you know.
The Battle of Blenheim.
Just the Battle of Blenheim goes on. It doesn't stop. It's every generation has to fight the battle for Blenheim.
You are quoted as saying that your motto is retain and restore rather than rip out and replace. What do you mean by this?
Well, I guess I have a passion for architectural heritage, history and authentic features. So, you know, I know everybody's very keen to bring their houses up into the 21st century, which I totally accept and believe in too. But I do get quite upset when people start ripping out wonderful features, whether it's a staircase or beautiful plasterwork, focal points in a house, just to make it the space livable for them. You know, if you're going to do that, why not build a new house? I try and encourage my clients in particular to look at their houses. If you bought the house because it's a Georgian house, then please retain those wonderful features.
I couldn't agree with you more. One of the things that I most enjoyed at Beaver was when I did up my late father-in-law's bedroom, he had a bed throw that was in shreds. And I remember taking elements of that wonderful piece of fabric and weaving it into a new bedspread I created for another bedroom. Nothing is ever thrown away in a large house.
Quite right.
So in your work, Henrietta, you place a great emphasis on the importance of practicality. Is practicality actually possible in stately homes, or are they more museums than places to live?
Well, speaking of Blenheim as an example, I think it is difficult to live in it practically as a family home. For example, we don't have a family kitchen here. There's not somewhere where my brother and sister-in-law can, you know, go and make a bowl of pasta if they want to or something like that. The kitchen is very much an industrial kitchen. So if they were to live here full-time with a family, there'd have to be, you know, quite a lot of strategic changes made and planning changes made to make it function as a family home. So Blenheim, as an example, is not practical. It could be made so. The other thing I find very difficult about Blenheim, and it didn't seem to bother my grandfather so much because there weren't so many visitors around, but there's no area of the garden where you can sit outside, read a book, have a barbecue without being overlooked, which certainly doesn't make it practical to live in.
No, and yet you've maintained that wonderful feeling of it not feeling like a museum.
I think on the private side, which is the East Wing, it's always been lived in as a family home. So although the rooms are large, they are cosy, they're very welcoming. They're not perfect by any means. You know, they're quite shabby chic, a lot of the bedrooms, because we don't have the revenue, the spare money to spend on doing them up. So we do things as and when we can, but they're certainly welcoming. I mean, one thing that I always find embarrassing, and I know you've had the same problem at Beaver, is having ensuite bathrooms or even shower rooms, because Blenheim, you know, was not built to install plumbing. A lot of the floors are solid, the walls are solid, and you can't just suddenly plonk a bathroom somewhere. You've got to think about the drain runs and where everything goes. So some people, especially the Americans, are quite horrified. A, they don't get a bathroom en suite, and B, they don't have a power shower.
No, we have exactly that problem. We luckily, the 8th Duchess, so I'm the 11th, put in the bathrooms. But if you look at the architecture of Beaver, they're literally hanging off the side of the building with big brackets holding these.
Well, we have the same in a courtyard. There's a couple of bathrooms which are supported on stilts. Which,
I mean, planners would have a field day today. But and like you, I have managed to get a bathroom in a broom cupboard at times, so it fits in.
Actually, I remember when I luckily had the pleasure of staying with you at Beaver for a shoot once, I was in a bedroom and there was a little shower room within the
bedroom. A cupboard.
Yes, it literally was. But I mean, it was just nice to have it there, you know. It didn't matter that it wasn't large or luxurious, it was there.
Well, it doesn't matter to you, but as you rightly say, there are many foreign visitors who struggle with it. How would you describe quintessentially your idea of British design?
Well, first of all, I always look at the house. And that's the starting point, the architecture of the house, the period of the house. Secondly, you have to take into account the people who are living in it and their lifestyle and the fact that actually the house is going to evolve over their period of living there, because the children might be young, the children might grow up, they might then have grandchildren. So you've got to plan it in a way that it's practical for each part of their life. I don't like really very over-the-top design. I like to keep it fairly understated, let the architecture speak for itself. I think it's very important to have good quality furniture. It doesn't have to be a lot. It can be a few statement pieces that make, you know, lovely focal point.
And that's antique furniture?
preferably, if it's a period home, it should have some period furniture in it. Art is different because art is very personal. So I don't often buy artwork for my clients because it's such a personal thing. You know, you can mix contemporary art with a classical setting, or vice versa. So that doesn't bother me so much. But equally, the art could be the starting point for a room. It might be so strong and such an important focal point that you then use that to take the colours from for the rest of the room.
There are some incredible works of art here at Blenheim Palace. What can you tell us about your favourite piece, Henrietta?
There are some wonderful pieces of art, but actually, if you think about it, they're mainly portraits. Because in those days, everybody just had portraits. So I think one of my favourites is that of the 9th Duke and Duchess, because it's so majestic. You've got the architectural background, and then you've got the wonderful composition of the Duke and Duchess and their two children. And it's sort of romantic, but it's also telling a story. And that's by John Singer Sargent. So that's one of my favourite pieces. But equally, I look at all the portraits and they're all telling a story.
That's the other thing that I found fascinating visiting homes, because the eyes are looking at you, and when you get to know the people behind the portrait, you realise they were not just a picture. They had their own story, they had their own feelings. Is there anyone that follows you when you're going around?
I always had great admiration for Sarah, the first Duchess, because I think for her time, she was incredibly formidable, forthright, successful lady. So, and apart from the else, she lived to be over 80, which, you know, outliving all but one of her children and some of her grandchildren. She always had sort of great loyalty, even though she never really wanted to build Blenheim. Once it had been built, she knew it was her life's work to continue looking after it and adding to it and protecting it. So I sort of do feel that perhaps she's someone who's looking out, you know, and thinking, now you're doing the right thing, I hope.
Oh, I love that. We seem to have that recurring theme through all the homes that we visit. There's a portrait somewhere and a pair of eyes that are following you and looking at you and keeping an eye on what you're doing. Mm. So we talked about the palace and inside the palace and in the interiors, which are so fond to your lifetime work. Can we now move on to the grounds? Which would be your favourite spot outside?
Ooh, that's a difficult one. I can't say I have a favourite spot, but I do rather like the old part of the park where all the beautiful oak trees are, which is perhaps also slightly more private.
Well, that's lovely. And gardens are something, another quintessential English thing. What would be for you an important part of a British garden?
Ooh, I think you automatically think of roses, don't you, when you have a British garden. And we do have a rose garden, which is en route down to the cascade, which is at the end of the lake, which again, I guess is slightly wasted because it's not somewhere where anybody, you know, would just go and sit on a sunny day because it's slightly off the beaten track. One of my favourite parts of the garden is what we call the secret garden. And actually, it was a project my father took on. It had been there for many years and it got neglected. And as the tercentenary, so the 300 years of Blenheim, he decided to renovate that and have it as a, you know, in memory of the tercentenary of the Battle of Blenheim. And that is not far from where we are now. It's on the east side and very, very pretty. And I think we're quite proud of the fact that we did most of that in-house with our own gardening team.
One of the things I will say to my three daughters, I've got five children, three old daughters come first, Violet, Alice and Eliza, is it's incredibly hard to find people who can be great role models, who've grown up in bits of British heritage as you have and my daughters have, and to take it all rather for granted. But you have to be, for me, that inspiration. And I think I've repeated this to you many a time, certainly to my daughters. If there's anyone you should mould yourself on, it is Lady Henrietta. Can you tell me, Henrietta, if you were going to speak to the First Duchess, if you were able to talk to her, what would you say?
Well, probably the other way around. What would she be telling me? She'd probably be saying, no, you should have done that differently, or you shouldn't have done that, or, you know, why didn't you marry into English aristocracy?
And, well, there's another point. You could have been our queen, apparently, once upon a time.
Well, no, I don't think there was any chance of that. I don't think that... I did actually go and stay at Windsor once for Royal Ascot, which has to have been one of the most exciting times of my life, sitting in that carriage going up the race course. I mean, really was one of the highlights of my life.
Amazing.
But no, I wouldn't want that role. Thank you very much. So I think, you know, the fact that I didn't marry into aristocracy and I didn't have a big estate to help run is probably why I've stayed here and forged out a career locally, not only independently for myself with my interior design business, but actually also to help with some of the running of the estate, because it's, I think it's firstly important to maintain the family history, and secondly, it's my passion.
And my very last question to you today is, what would you say to your great-great-great niece who will one day come and live in Blenheim Palace?
Gosh, who knows what will be happening then? They'll probably rather go and live on Mars or somewhere much more exciting. Well, you know what I hope is, I hope that the future generations have as much passion as I do about the heritage, the history. And I was thinking about this the other day. I was thinking, you know, perhaps in a couple of generations' time, people aren't going to be interested in who Sir Winston Churchill was. You know, maybe it won't be taught in schools. It's still fairly fresh, and there's still family members who direct descendants of him alive and still passionate about what he achieved and very proud of it. But maybe there won't be in a few generations' time. So I'm hoping that history will still be taught and it will carry on through the generations and people will be able to appreciate, you know, why they're there and how they got there.
So rather like the first Duchess, you could well be looking at your great-great-great-great nieces and saying, get on with it.
Well, yes, and, you know, appreciate it and save it for the next generation.
Oh, goodness me, they're very lucky to have you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been such fun.
Unsung hero of our British heritage, Lady Henrietta Spencer Churchill. Henrietta's closing wish that future generations maintain the same level of passion for heritage is so touching. Given the level of diligence and passion that Henrietta has thrown into her work, not only in preserving Blenheim, but also in her profession, I am in absolutely no doubt that generation after generation, they will continue to fight the Battle of Blenheim. Thank you so much, Henrietta, for joining me on the show and sharing your family home with us all. And thank you all for listening. We will return next week when I sit down with one of Merseyside's greatest treasures, Lady Derby of Knowsley Hall. I get an incredible insight into the Earls and their distinguished equestrian tradition. Lady Derby opens up about her life and heritage, and I'm informed of Knowsley's unbelievable connection to Shakespeare. Couple of quick notes before we go. Important ones. Make sure you subscribe to Duchess the podcast so you get automatically notified about new episodes wherever you listen to a podcast. I want to know about you and what you think of the show. So please be sure to send me your comments and tell me about your own lineage and the women who have inspired you in your life. Please write to me on duchess@duchessthepodcast.com. And if there are any stately homes in particular you'd like me to visit, do send your suggestions to me as soon as possible. I've started a newsletter that includes all this and more and comes straight to your inbox. It's really easy to sign up at duchessthepodcast.com. You've been listening to Duchess, the podcast, presented by me, Emma Rutland, the Duchess of Rutland, produced by One Fine Play in collaboration with Beaver Castle. From Beaver Castle, Lady Violet Manners is the executive producer. From One Fine Play, James Bishop is the executive producer. Kasra Ferruzia is the audio and visual engineer. Connor Foley is the editorial producer and researcher. Additional creative support from Selena Christofies and Theo Banner. Thanks for listening to Duchess, the podcast.